Oregon State Hospital Patient Care, February 6, 2008, it's about 5:32, 5:33 p.m. in the evening, hearing of C. We continue our oversight, and we will hear from Bob Nickel, the Assistant Director, Addictions and Mental Health Division Department, Department for Human Services.
Can I mention one thing real quick, though?
Yes, Rick McGilvray wants to say something.
Thank you, Chair, and just for the members, we are scheduled to meet every Wednesday, except there is a conflict for the 13th next Wednesday, so we'll be scheduling the day before or the day after, either the evening of the 12th or the 14th at 5:30. If there's a better or worse day for you, we'll cancel but find out. So just take the 13th off. I'll send out a notice.
I noticed that Dr. Goldberg, the head of Human Resources, has come before us, as well as Superintendent Mr. Hammer. How are you going to do this? This threesome. I don't care who goes first. You're going to go first. All right, Doctor. All right, and then you'll work from that. All right, and then when they get through, we can. I'm trying to think whether I'm going to do what I did last time. Remember last time they talked, and we didn't ask any questions. They got through talking. That was hard for some of you. So I think for emotional reasons, I will. allow you to question the individuals, you know, if you want to, while they're speaking. Because otherwise, I mean, Diane last time was just going nuts, and Margaret, who's out getting a sandwich, was going nuts. So I don't want to put up with that anymore. So if you want to ask a question, then we'll do it. So you're going to have to take interruptions as you come here today to testify. Is that all right?
Fine with us.
All right, with that little thing, Bob Nickel, do you wish to speak first, please?
Yes, I do. Co-chairs and members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Nickel, Assistant Director to Bruce, Department of Human Services, and I'm responsible for the Addictions and Mental Health Division. Our purpose in tonight is to present steps that the state hospital is taking to improve the conditions at the hospital, very simply enough. I'll first provide a listing of major initiatives that we've accomplished since late 2006, and then Interim Superintendent Maynard Hammer will provide additional detail on action steps, major measurements and benchmarks, and timelines for achieving the goals. We're attempting to be responsive to the questions and concerns that came up last week.
So this is since late 2006?
Co-Chair Courtney, primarily there are a few things that probably go back a little bit before that, but I want to go back and talk about what we have been doing since the time that we knew the DOJ was coming and since they've been here.
And we'll establish that for the record, that they came on, what, November 15th, 16th, 17th, right?
Well, November of 2006, that
right,
would be correct.
Okay. Go ahead, please.
First thing that I'm going to, let me back up just a minute. I'm going to tell you things that are in process. They're not all completed. They're not all things that we can just walk away from at this point and assume that everything will be fine. So I want to make it clear that I'm saying these things in that spirit. I'm trying to say these things in a spirit of non-defensiveness. I'm not trying to defend the hospital or make it look good, either one. I'm just trying to tell you as best I can factually what we've been doing. And I certainly do welcome any questions that come up. The first thing I want to talk about is improvements in our data system, and this is something that is ongoing. One thing that I'm not sure people are aware of is that Oregon State Hospital finally entered the personal computer age 3 years ago. 3 years ago. Before that, we had a mainframe, very cumbersome, difficult to navigate computer system, a database. We still use it. It collects basic demographic information and things like admission and discharge and type of civil commitment, criminal commitment, etc. The point in telling you this is that we're behind many hospitals in being able to collect data systematically. That doesn't mean we aren't starting to do that, but a lot of what you're going to see in our measurements are the result of individual staff initiatives figuring out individual databases. Where we're going eventually in the next year or two, and particularly with the new state hospital, is the BHIP, the Behavioral Health Integration Project. That will be a state-of-the-art computer system that's linked to the communities. It will cover addictions as well as mental health. It'll cover all ages, and it'll be much more responsive to data requests.
You said next year or two. When?
I will turn to Maynard Hammer for that.
Co-chairs, member of the Joint Legislative Committee on Oregon State Hospital Patient Care, I'm Maynard Hammer, Interim Superintendent, Oregon State Hospital. The technology package that Bob is referring to is part of the hospital replacement project. Most of you are probably aware the new hospital on the Salem campus scheduled to open in 2011. The current goals for the technology package is to start having the components of that in place a year ahead of time so the hospital staff can get used to it and start trying to figure out how to bring the work with those systems, since it'll be a major step from where we are today.
So nothing till 2010?
That's correct.
Why? I don't know about these things, but I don't understand. It's 2008, 2009, nothing, anything.
Co-Chair Courtney, the process for designing these projects is very intensive. It's been going on for about a year, and we have a team of staff who are working on this, but that's the nature of the reality. Maynard can probably provide you more detail, but my understanding is that this is a typical time frame for getting such a comprehensive data system into place.
Well, maybe that's the usual time, but when you got, when you're under watch by the U.S. Department of Justice, can that not influence the people who certified smart to do these things to accelerate it? I'm just asking. I don't know. This is the usual job that they're going to be doing. You know, we got the U.S. Department of Justice putting us on watch, possible lawsuit that could conceivably take over the whole mental health system. Does that not enter in at all, this discussion that we can't wait? I don't know. I mean, you could.
Co-Chair Courtney, I think that's a good question. We'll take it back and look at it. I'm sure that it would take some additional resources, and we can have that conversation.
Can I ask just a very basic question? Because we always talk about, when we come before our committees, that part of the reason that some things don't get done is because we don't have new high-tech data systems. And my question will be related to some of the service issues that were pointed out in the Department of Justice's recommendation. Do they all relate and link to the having to have the data system in place? What are some of the other critical services or things that will be needed in order to meet those recommendations and those problems that were pointed out by the Department of Justice?
Co-Chair and Vice Chair Winters, many of the requirements or recommendations do not require the completion of the entire BHIP or the Behavioral Health Integration Project. Some of them probably don't require as much, but one of the things you're going to hear as a theme throughout our presentation is we're trying to get much more serious about metrics, measurements, so that we don't just think that we're doing something. We want to be able to measure whether it's actually happening. We will be able to measure most of the things that we're going to talk about, but it won't be within one integrated system yet. There are a series of databases that have been created through staff initiative, and that's what we're going to rely on for our metrics, our measurements.
Representative Berger, please. You have a
thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, I don't know what the Behavioral Health Integration Project is, but it sounds a lot bigger than the state hospital. And we heard we read in the CRIPA report that there's just some basic one section of the hospital talking to another, and that, it doesn't seem to me, would take an entire behavioral health integration project. So I guess I want to know that somewhere you can punch in patient information here in the hospital, and it's going to crop up at a nursing station over there, and they all know the same thing, which is a lot less than a complete project with health, public, mental health, and addictions. I guess that's what I'm looking for, rather than this is great. I don't know whether it's an off-the-shelf or who you're working with to purchase this kind of software. I'm sure it's out there. But I think that's what I'm looking for, is what are you doing about the nurse on the in the ward having the critical information that she or he needs to deal with the patient coming out of. And that's important data management.
Co-Chairs, Representative Berger, let me try and answer that. What you're really talking about is part of where we're headed. Hospitals use electronic medical records for that kind of information. Electronic medical records have information that's captured and displayed in ways that comply with the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act and confidentiality. And they also have a lot of different fields because all of our patients are different. We have some patients on 25 medications. We have some that are on 5 or 6, and some don't take any. All of those have to be accounted for and passed from one treatment team to another. And the common way of doing that is an electronic medical record, and that's where we're trying to get to. There are a lot of electronic medical records out there. The basic problem we have is what we're using now is a 35-year-old mainframe system, so we're trying to jump a 40-year gap, trying to get all of these areas up to date at once, and meanwhile we need to get our treatment care planning in place so that there's uniformity and consistent communication among the 22 treatment teams. That's the area where the electronic communication and the electronic medical record is going to help us a great deal. One can't do that with an email system, and that's really all we have at this point is the stuff that we have designed and are using now. Incident reporting and those kinds of things. We're taking advantage of the Department of Human Services email system and databases that people are setting up in Access or Excel just for those technical reports so we can answer questions that people ask us. Those don't have very much depth, and they don't allow us to move around a lot of information from one treatment team to another in a way that it's helpful for physicians, nurses, psychologists, social workers, all members of the treatment team to actually use it. That's one reason why this is being it's a complex project. There are a lot of electronic medical records being used by hospitals out there, and just trying to get one that will work with the state of Oregon systems and do all the compliance issues that we have to do. That's why it's taking so long. And you're right, we are trying to make use of the resources we have as we talk through some of the issues that are in the CRIPA report. I have 2 pages of reports that we collect. We get them. They're all hard copy. They're stored in binders, and when we want to do a report to answer your question or the press questions or to try to figure out, as you will see in the CRIPA report, what do we feed back to the treatment team and how do we improve treatment care planning using this information, it's hand-calculated out of those notebooks. And so to do anything meaningful takes quite a while, and it's we have to pick the biggest targets of opportunity to do that because there's no way to have a continuous feed of information back. Your point is right on, and that's where we're trying to get to.
So, Mr. Chair, I had a comment. And I think, gentlemen, one thing that might be helpful as you go through these initiatives is that, you know, we're not experts on hospital management here. And so sometimes when you're talking about things that might sound just sort of like they're the greatest solutions since sliced bread, to us they sound kind of like bureaucratic stuff that we don't understand. I think as you go through these, if you could maybe be somewhat more specific about how these changes would address the kinds of problems that we've read about and heard about in the report, that I would find really helpful. And I'm sure there probably are examples. And I'm not asking you to refute point by point the things that are in the letter from the USDOJ, but I think, at least for me, that, you know, rather than just telling us data collection, how is that going to improve people not getting inappropriate medication or something like that would be helpful. And I think as we get to the staffing issues, probably that would be an area where you might want to talk about how that's going to improve patient care. So
Madam Co-Chair and members of the committee, and indeed that's exactly what we're going to get you into that level of detail a little bit later. What I was intending to do was to give you some overview so that some of these other issues have a context in which you can put them. So we will try our best not to put this into bureaucratic language. We frankly don't appreciate when people talk to us that way any more than you appreciate it when we talk to you that way. So thank you for keeping us honest.
Senator Leonard, Representative Jensen.
Because thank you, Mr. Chair, because your number one item that you referred to is the item of electronic records and the data system. And I'm going to speak from my old past experience. One time, most of you may or may not knew that I was going to be a medical record librarian. So, I'm sitting here very troubled, and I understand that the electronic records now is the new thing, but that doesn't take away from the hard copy that provides the notes of your staff with which to share with other staff. So I'm trying to sit here to grapple with, and I thoroughly understand that we're going to get into the new environment and what have you. But for me, I need to know until we get there. How are we going to address and deal with the management of the information? Because we can't wait till 2010. And that's what I want to hear you talk about and address.
Co-Chairs, Vice Chair Winters, the basic medical record is still a hard copy medical record. And what we're talking about is other databases that can help us assess in a systematic way questions that we all have. What is the range of medications? How many doctors prescribed what different types of medications? You know, what about seclusion or restraint records overall? I want to emphasize that we still have the hard copy, old-fashioned medical records. So that's not going to be out of the picture until we get the Behavioral Health Integration Project information system in place.
Representative Jensen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. And I think both the one co-chair and Senator Winters have kind of spoken around to the concern or the issues that I would have them be concerned or talk about it here. And you know, fundamentally, and I recognize that, in the report, the comments about an inadequate system, and I recognize a need for an updated of the system, the records-keeping system or the technology. I would never see that as a defense of the failure to deliver some of the other things that are present in the report. That had those other things, been taken care of, if you wish, in the old-fashioned way, whatever that might have been, the report would not have raised itself to the level that it has in the state of Oregon, and the lack of having the technology wouldn't have reached the attention to this level. And I don't want to imply, Mr. Co-Chair, that technology is not important, and that technology will not help improve the efficiency with which patients may be tracked and followed and taken care of over a variety of places within the system, even outside of the state hospital per se. But it's hardly. I don't want to blame the technology because we did a lot of things efficiently long before we had any technology.
See it, please.
Co-Chair and Representative Jensen, I agree entirely that the answer is not a new database. It's really getting at the issues of good patient care. Database can be a great tool and can help us communicate and help us understand patterns and trends, but I agree entirely with your perspective. Let me continue on and talk about some.
Just a minute, Rick.
Before you leave the computer database program, too, will this development contain like a treatment plan? I guess one of the, if it's something which is actually going to show a treatment plan, collect data, it's going to tell you potentially where problems are before they actually become big problems. Is this part of the
kind of grand plan? I mean, is it, or just going to be collecting demographic and...
Co-chairs, Mr. Berkovian. Yeah, the advantage of a well-designed program will be it'll help us catch errors, it'll help us catch contradictions, and all of those kind of things. So it'll be an assist in treatment planning as well as discharge planning and follow-up in the community, for that matter. Another set of concerns that we heard loud and clear on Friday was the issue of hand washing. So I asked the infection control manager, Richard O'Brien, to provide me with the 2007 infection control and employee health report. I've provided the committee with copies of excerpts from that that I thought focused particularly on the kind of concerns. We've really emphasized in 2007, hand washing, influenza shots, surveillance, occupational exposure, body, blood and body fluids, particularly needle stick prevention, and improving monitoring systems for a whole variety of infections, especially, but not exclusively, of course, on the geropsychiatric units. The gero units have people who are particularly vulnerable to infections, and we have really stepped up far before we got the report from the U.S. DOJ. All of those efforts. So Mr. Hammer may go into a little bit more detail, but I wanted to provide you with the information, and you may have some questions about the material there, but I think that it's reassuring to me and hopefully to you that this whole issue of whether we have a good hand-washing approach and it has received major attention, and I think we're making significant progress in that area. I just want to comment, too, that the influenza shots, which are really protective for staff and patients, received a major boost. We, in years past, had apparently, I really didn't even know this until reading the report, we would actually give flu shots materials back. This time it was the opposite. We had so many staff and patients demanding them that we actually had to order additional. I think that's a credit to the hospital. And I know in talking to Richard O'Brien, he very modestly said it wasn't him, it was really the interim superintendent, the director of nursing, and key union representatives. In my office, if you come in my office, you'll see a color poster with two of our key union leaders emphasizing the need for people to wash hands. And I think it's that sort of collaborative, greater awareness and much greater attention to this issue that has taken place. But I appreciate the concerns that came up at the Friday session, and I wanted to particularly give a report back to you on that.
So, So the report talked about the number of 28 deaths, 15 related to pneumonia or infection-related conditions, right? You remember that? Mm-hmm. So what does that figure look like in 2007 since you've used the figure? I mean, I assume you're measuring... That was what's so devastating. They went on to talk about mice and scabies and messes. So there's no more mice, there's no more scabies, there's no more messes. I mean, I have to relate in everyday lay language like that for me to understand what you just said about where people washing our hands and major improvements made. I don't doubt it. I just, that is why we were told we knew people weren't washing their hands, etc. So relate to it in that way if you can.
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, let me try to address some of those. Those are damning kinds of statements in a report from the U.S. DOJ. We've looked behind some of those, and here's what we have. We have an old facility. We have pests there. We have ground squirrels. We have rats. We have mice. We have pest control contracts. We train our housekeepers. We train infection control. Everybody knows that there's pests there, and we try our best to keep them out. Patients do eat some on treatment units. That attracts some of these pests, but they are there, and we do take action to try to keep them out of there. They're very... we have an old industrial kitchen with a big crawl space under it. It's very difficult in these old buildings to keep things out of there. We have a variety of outbreaks. And as we look at the statistics, our outbreaks and our handling of those are probably no greater than most acute care hospitals because, frankly, the patients at Oregon State Hospital with the psychiatric illnesses don't have the same kind of exposures as in many acute care hospitals with all the physical illnesses. I look behind the facts on a lot of the pneumonia statistics cited in the report. The cause of death is often cited as pneumonia, but it's brought on by terminal cancer. chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. A lot of these folks are traumatic brain injured. They have problems eating. They've had problems for years, and their advanced age, and they get aspirational pneumonia, which means they ingest food into their lungs, and it creates infections, and that's where the pneumonia comes from. And their families work with us and choose not to continue medications. We look back at what you might call infectious deaths from pneumonia that are actually were either related to MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. That's a staph infection that you've seen in the press lately. We've had exactly two deaths in 2003 that I can't pinpoint to some underlying cause because of a major illness or a long-standing brain injury or some other disability, severe dementia or Alzheimer's, where the person cannot eat right and is approaching the end of life anyway. We have a number of norovirus outbreaks. We have regular surveillance. We take quick action. We invite the public health division in. They do come in. They consult with us. They have said on numerous times in these big old facilities where you have large groupings of people, if you bring it in, and it may not be hospital cause, it could be a visitor coming in, it could be a staff person coming to work, it could be a new patient. We don't know where these all come from. But we contain them, we quarantine the treatment units, we take action, we send our housekeepers in, we do infection control techniques, we sanitize and disinfect everything. We do as much as we can to keep those things from progressing, and we've not had a death.
All right, let me ask the question another way then, because you sort of are saying, Superintendent, that number 5, infection control, bottom of page 29, continuing the top of page 30, is not correct. You're now taking issue with the finding report. Let me ask the question this way. Neither OSH staff nor its patients comply with generally accepted standards for hand washing. That's no longer the case out there, is that right?
Mr. Co-Chair, hand washing is one of those basic universal precautions that we teach everybody. We train on it. I can't tell you. Is it a widespread problem? We believe it is not a widespread problem.
Indeed, documents reviewed reference nursing staff who administered medication and engaged in other patient care activities without washing their hands. So there's some kind of documents out there that showed they weren't washing their hands. I don't know what the documents were. That doesn't go on anymore. Is that right? Because you now must have documents to show they're washing their hands. Is that right? I'm not trying to trick you. I don't know how else to ask these questions.
We have... Mr. Co-Chair, we are trying to observe the treatment units, and we are trying to enforce all of the hand washing.
Can't enforce it by there's a standard.
Yes.
It's out there. It's on the walls. It's a document. I don't know.
That's correct. It's sent out in emails. We've had a fair on it contest. It's on our infection control manager puts it on the bottom of every email he sends out.
Thank you. Any other questions? Please, Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. The number I read as I look at that paragraph was 28 patient deaths that occurred between January 2005 and, Mr. Superintendent, you mentioned 2003, and I don't track between what they're saying here and the January 2005 to August 2016, 15 of those deaths were from pneumonia. The data you gave indicated that there were two deaths in a similar time period or the exact time period that you couldn't come with a specific reasoning.
Co-chairs, Vice Chair Hanna, I'll get you the information. My comments were meant to, we do have deaths. We have a lot of people put on failing lists. The cause of death is not because they caught pneumonia largely in the hospital. That was the...
Yeah, thank you. I think we understood that. I think we've got to lay that out and make it clear because, I mean, in my mind, honestly, I'm seeing kind of a matrix here that you would begin to form because I think everybody sitting here has a copy of the report and their highlighted notes, and they're all looking at this saying, you know, 28 deaths, 15 from pneumonia. I think your description was medically correct. I mean, there's pneumonia from a lot of other reasons. This just says from pneumonia. But it would be good for us, for you, to tell us from January 2005 to August 2006, of the 15 deaths from pneumonia, none of them were from these other things, they were all cancer and the other things you described, or some of them we can't describe or whatever. So I'm just looking at this matrix that says, let's compare what they're saying here to some of the facts that you have collected.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. That's basically where I was going to. But one addition to that, somewhere there must be norming on these types of things within hospitals. There must be some standards that if you go beyond, you're in real serious trouble, and if you are lower than such and such, you're the best hospital in the nation type of thing. I mean, it would help if we had some comparison. All we're getting is numbers, and any death by, you know, is tragic and traumatic for the people perhaps that are involved with it. And I know it's traumatic for the, you know, for your staff out there when you go through a death, but that they did not see coming. But if there's some sort of standards that might at least help me understand what 25 deaths from pneumonia in a population of 700 means, given the, you know, et cetera type of thing, would be very helpful.
Senator Winters, you have a...
I have a request, which I think will help facilitate the process. Have you sat down and gone and reviewed the DOJ document, the recommendations that they made, the problems that they identified, so that you can respond to those? If you have, I think that would, if you shared that kind of information to us, then we could look at the 28 deaths or whatever you're saying. Because if I recall that the review and investigation started in 2006, or when we're talking 2008. So one of the issues is what kinds of corrections have occurred since the investigation. What is the response from the state hospital management to the allegations that were made? I think that helps us, and so that we're not having images in our head about something that may be real or not real.
Co-chairs, Vice Chair Winters, that's actually exactly what we have for you. We developed what we called the Continuous Improvement Plan before we ever got the report back from the USDOJ in January. As soon as we got the report, we looked at our plan and we crosswalked it. We indexed every single recommendation against what we had already anticipated we would be dealing with in our plan. We now have an action plan that details what we're going to do about every single recommendation and how we're going to measure it and who's responsible and what our timeline is.
And does that action plan, follow up, Mr. Chair, does that action plan include some of a response to DOJ with the problems that they pointed out? Not just the action plan, because I think I hear this committee talking about 28 deaths. How did we get to 28 deaths? And some of that kind of information.
Co-Chair, Vice Chair Winters, I don't recall off the top of my head that they specifically had a recommendation about the deaths issue, but I think that's something we owe you and can give you that information.
Thank you. Please proceed. Oh, excuse me. Representative Friend, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question, because I do want to let you get to what, I mean, some of these things I know you are part of your presentation forthcoming, but I had one basic question. Could you tell me whether the report from the Department of Justice only covered activities and incidents and stories from the hospital, or I've heard some testimony, a lot of my constituents work for you, as you probably know. I've heard some testimony, some of them feel that this report is covering things occurring at group homes and being labeled as having occurred at the hospital, but the opening page makes it look like it's only things at the hospital. So if you have an opinion on that, I'd like to hear it.
Co-Chairs, Representative Clem, I know of one example. And when I talk about this, I'm not trying to dispute the entire report, because I think that for the most part the report was very fair, and I think it's given us the challenge and the map of where we need to go. I do know that we've checked one particular incident. And there, if you remember, there was a patient who was alleged to have swallowed, I don't know, 30 spoons. Mm-hmm. That actually happened in a Department of Corrections facility. We admitted the person and frankly saved the guy's life. So I know there was one story like that that we went back and tracked, but I don't want to, you know, it's not my purpose to rebut every single finding, but I do know that staff felt very concerned that there were a couple of things that they knew for sure had not happened at the hospital, and I think it's only fair for us to acknowledge that there is at least one example of that. And we'll, you know, we can go back and see if there are any other particular things along that line.
Just brief follow-up, Mr. Chair. My only concern isn't to excuse it. It's to say, does the scope of this committee's work, since we're now assuming the next 1,000 patients in the next 20 years are going to all happen out in the community, does the scope of our ongoing oversight work need to include group homes, just like we're going to go through every single, you know, nook and cranny of your facility? Because it seems like it's going to have to.
We'd like to say that our rules require that all cell phones be turned off, please. Please proceed.
I want to move on and talk about the additional nurses. We requested and were given resources to hire 17 additional nurses. We've done that. We have a relatively new and a very energetic, capable director of nursing services, Nancy Franz-Geddes. She's overhauled the nursing assessment process, including risk for falls, pain level assessment, and reviewing trauma history. She's also revised pharmacy procedures. But the point I want to make about the nursing vacancies is that she's through hard work and through working with the department's recruitment staff, we've moved the vacancy rate from about 22% about a year ago to 11 or 12% today. I think that's remarkable. Most state hospitals around the country are running about a 20% nursing vacancy rate. It's part of another planning process that we've been involved with, which is to deal with the nursing shortage, particularly psychiatric nursing shortage. If I could just back up real quickly, too, and talk about the comparison and benchmarks that Representative Jensen asked about. It's a very good question. We do participate in a National Research Institute, which is part of my trade association, the National Association of State Mental Health Program Directors. And so we are part of a system nationwide that collects and benchmarks data on a whole variety of issues. It's called ORYX, O-R-Y-X. We are working on getting a document ready for you if you'd like to see that, which would show on all of the areas where we collect information through the ORYX process how we compare to the rest of the country. I would also add that every state hospital is a little bit different. Alaska Psychiatric Institute, for example, the state hospital in Alaska, treats acute care patients primarily. We don't treat any acute care patients. We do only forensic and longer-term care, geropsychiatric, and some court-ordered evaluation. So when you compare state hospital data, you do have to recognize that you have to understand that different state hospitals have a different mix of patients. But we do have that data and are prepared to provide that for you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative,
so this is an area I would like to hear you talk a little more about in relation to some of the problems and how staffing shortages might have resulted in some of the things that are being cited. And I mean, you know better than I do about how those two things correlate, but I mean, some of the things that we read are a lack of initial assessments. I don't know if those are done by psychiatrists or psychiatric nurses, but in general, things like a lack of proper treatment planning seems to be an ongoing thread through this report, as well as inappropriate medications, and I assume that you need to have some sort of license to give people medications, at least initially. So could you talk about how, I mean, and what the challenges are, I guess, too, is what I'd like to hear about. What are the challenges of filling these positions? Because I'm sure it's not easy. We know about the shortages in nursing and medical facilities generally, but in this situation, I'm sure these are hard jobs. So
Right. Co-Chair Rosenbaum, you're right. These are hard jobs. When you run a vacancy rate of over 20%, it makes it that much more challenging to get all of the data collected in the nursing assessment. Nurses, of course, unless they're a nurse practitioner, don't prescribe. So that's an area we'll talk about in a little bit. And one of the approaches that we took there was to form a contract with Oregon Health and Sciences University to bring six psychiatrists under a contract. And we've been running vacancies. And in fact, in looking at the last year, it looked like we averaged about 6 to 9 vacancies of doctors. The average time it takes to fill a psychiatrist position is almost 9 months. So it's a combination of salary, working conditions, and frankly, finding the right people who are willing to work in the public psychiatry treatment program, particularly in a largely forensic hospital. So when we run high levels of vacancies, it's harder to keep up with the work. We still need to find ways to do that, and we need to find efficiencies, and we're working at that as well. So I don't want to lay all of the blame at the footstool of vacancies, but we do have to work very diligently on salaries, recruitment, retention, and all of those kind of things to make sure that we keep staffing up to where it needs to be.
Representative May.
Thank you, Mr. President. Speaking of salaries, could you talk a little bit about that? I'd heard that the salaries for nurses in the hospital were lower than in the private sector. Can you talk some about
Co-Chair Representative Tomei, the salaries are still not quite at the benchmark level for Salem area nurses. It's particularly problematic, however, if you want to become a nurse manager, you will take a significant cut in pay. And these are issues that we're working on with the Department of Administrative Services. These are critical structural issues that we need to work through. Our comparisons show that if you're a nurse manager, you're going to make considerably less than you would if you took a private sector or a position, say, at Salem Hospital. And those are parts of the hospital improvement plan that we do need to work on.
Mr. Co-Chair, could we ask for more information regarding this and what it is that perhaps this committee can be doing about that? It seems ludicrous, especially after this report comes out, that we're asking people to take these very, very difficult jobs under very difficult circumstances, and we're going to be paying them less, especially in the time when we've got a nursing shortage. We're going to be paying them less than they could get in the private sector, which would probably not be as difficult as we're asking these people to work at.
Can I just ask, give me your vacancies and tell me what they are today.
Chair Courtney, I don't have that off the top of my head, but we'll get it for you.
I'm one of all categories.
All right, we'll get that for you.
The percentages are fine. I'm not trying to be pejorative in any way at all. You asked for, way back in 2003-04, you asked for a 10% increase in salary pays for medical professionals. You remember that? And so you've eaten all that up. Is that grant? I think that was a grant. Was that? Is that all gone? Obviously, we responded at that time in terms of salary increases, did we not?
Co-Chair, I believe that we did work with you on that, and we added those. The problem is that salaries everywhere keep going up.
I understand
that. It's a competitive environment.
It's not like we haven't been approached. I'd like to hear what salaries you think, but I also want to hear the exact number of positions in each, the title of the person that should be in the position. Otherwise, I don't know how to relate to 22% and 11% in terms of people today that should be out there to create the staff-patient ratios that we got bombarded on last week out there. Right? That's all.
Co-Chair, yes, I understand. I'm just checking to see if we might have that available right here, but we will get it for you.
Right.
I had the same question, and I'd like for it to include, to go beyond the nursing issue, but for all staff, and I'd also like to add staff turnover rates in all categories. I think that if we're going to get into the staff salary issues, we also have to get into the turnover rate issues. In addition, and I think I've asked for it for years, I want to know what our workers' comp rates are and the injury rates that occur with staff.
Co-Chair, Vice Chair Winters, we have that information and we'll get it for you.
Senator Carter, please.
Thank you. Bob, I'm interested in those little day-to-day things that happen, because every time I think about the report and I would see where there were some areas of concern that people had that caused them or lead them to infectious diseases. And that is, what about your maintenance staff
because one of the things in the report referred to something that where maintenance staff or your janitorial staff would be cleaning up after something happened. Do you have a shortage there? What is the problem along those lines?
Co-chair, Senator Carter, the janitorial staff, which we call housekeeping staff, which we do train in infection control and disinfection, they really are first-line defense and against infection. We have about half the number we need for the number of treatment units we have. We do not have a housekeeper for every treatment unit. We use patient pay crews in most of our, in all of our 8 wards in the 50 building. We use patient pay in our transitional units. They're supervised by an employee, and if we have disinfection necessary or we have an infection control issue, then we do a crew of our regular housekeepers that come in on a weekend or at night and take care of that.
Further questions?
Sure.
The one thing that still stands out in my mind so much is the issue around feces being left on the floor and that kind of thing. And if indeed you have staff and you have management and some kind of FLOW, flow control, of where things are happening, why would that be pointed out in such a way that you would think that people would immediately clean up behind that kind of thing? Why? But that still stands out so much in my mind. It just seems as if there is no continuity in how the place is kept clean.
Co-chair, Senator Carter, there's absolutely no excuse for us leaving that kind of mess around, and we're doing everything we can to make sure that that never happens again. Could it happen again? I suppose theoretically it could, but that's completely unacceptable, and I don't know how to put it strongly enough. It doesn't matter how many staff we have to clean up messes.
Right. But how do we, Bob, I think my question become, because I don't mean to go back and ding you on something we've already discussed, but how do we make sure, what kind of plans, management plans are you putting in place so that kind of thing can happen again? I don't want to hear about that one. That's something that doesn't take money, and that's something that doesn't call for technology. I mean, that's just plain old simple dignity toward other people and respect for being able to clean up things. How do we motivate? How do we get staff involved to the point where they find it necessary to clean up and get it done without somebody saying, go clean up room 101 or room 105, you know?
Co-chair, Senator Carter, I think you're really getting at one of the core issues, and that is that we need to create, if it isn't already there now, a culture where that's viewed as completely unacceptable because
Absolutely.
Of the dignity issues that are involved and because of the health issues. So I think the starting place is being really clear about our values and our instructions to staff about what's acceptable or not. And then within that, there's the monitoring, surveillance, dealing with any problems as they come up. But I think it starts with that core issue of respect and dignity and health. A lot of the core values that Dr. Goldberg has been talking about ever since he got here. And frankly, we've been talking about too, but we need to make sure that there's no equivocation or a mixed message on that issue.
No question. Dr. Goldberg, can you tell me if you send the same kind of messages? Oh, one of your employees was telling me that the thing that they enjoy in the area in which they work is that they get little messages, daily messages from you in terms of encouragement. Does that same thing happen at the hospital? Do you send those messages to the hospital as well?
Co-chair, Senator Carter, I send a weekly message to all of our staff, the hospital, those throughout the state, everywhere, and try and touch on a variety of issues, some informational and some about indeed looking at how we create a culture of excellence and of service throughout the whole organization.
How often do you meet with management people, or does Bob meet with management people at the hospital to have the rah-rah-rah kind of thing going on at the hospital?
Co-Chair Senator Winters, I meet with the key leadership of the state hospital at least once a week. We have frequent contact in between times. We have a governing body that meets every quarter. We have meetings where they come to my office, I go out there. I frankly could probably spend more time out there. I know I was out there after the DOJ report was released, and I've heard nothing but good feedback about, you know, having my visibility out there, and it's something that I'm resolved to do more of. I think it is critical that I get out there. But in terms of frequent face-to-face contact with Mr. Hammer and the key management staff, that happens on at least a once-a-week basis.
No question.
Mr. Hammer, how many employees do you have?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Carter, roughly 1,200.
1,200?
Yes.
At the State Hospital?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's on two campuses, Salem and Portland.
How engaged are you with lower-level staff so that they can feel the presence of the administrator around them as well?
The superintendent being out among the treatment units is very important. Dr. Fickle did that a lot. I have not been out there nearly as much as I used to be as deputy superintendent with the CRIPA and the other things going on. That's my fault. It is important, and it's a necessary thing to do. We have three shifts. We have 1,200 people. We have 2,000 patients, and I know a lot of those patients. That's about 2,000 people at the state hospital.
Mr. Chair, the direction in which I was going with my questioning is that somewhere along the line there's a link that is missing here. And that link, I'm sure, has everything to do with what Dr. Goldberg has said, is there is a culture that obviously needs to be dealt with in such a way where employees are feeling that they're in a partnership, and that this partnership calls for the quote-unquote dignity of man issue. Because when you find a group of people who are understaffed, underpaid, and working very hard and mandated to work longer hours as a result of not having staffing, that creates a kind of feeling among themselves that even if they wanted to not do overtime, they almost feel like they have to do overtime because there's no staff there. So in this partnership, it just appears to me, I think all you guys know me well enough to know that I can raise hell with the best of them. And I'm trying not to do that here, because I think we do need to promote this partnership between the state legislature and state institutions. And that's what I want to do. But I have to tell you, now you're going to see the wrath of me the next time around if on you guys watch I see this kind of stuff going on again. But right now, I feel as if that we're in this together. Nobody can point in a hand at anybody else, that all of us have to work through this together to create a better climate at the hospital and to also create an engaged relationship by which public employees are feeling real good about their contribution. And that's really important. That's where I was heading with those questions.
The overtime situation, you know, that was heavy in here. Where is the overtime situation 2007, which is an extension of Senator Carr's comments?
Mr. Co-Chair, our overtime situation is not materially changed. It is not materially changed.
Not trying to be argumentative, and you just need to tell me, not tonight, anytime in the near future, because I don't understand this. They were talking about how you've increased staffing, still short, and yet you're telling me, if you remember the materials here, unless you want to contradict it, there was so much overtime, it could have funded 41 new positions or something like that. You're telling me that hasn't changed in 2007.
Mr. Co-Chair, that's correct. Our overtime is still too high, and it is.
All right. One last thing, and then you've got to go on, I guess. The area of rodents and rats and mice, just Senator Carter reminded us about something she was saying. 60% of that building hasn't been occupied, in decades? You know what I'm talking about? I've taken tours today. They wouldn't allow me to take tours in the same place because it's filled with pigeon dung. It's a mess. The old buildings attract rodents and rats and things. I'd like you to come back and tell me how much of the rodent problem or the rat problem or the mice problem is due to those facilities that haven't been occupied for at least 30 years out there. I want to know that because it's just amazing. I'm sure you know areas I'm talking about. So I'd like, again, you tell me that. Please, you want to go ahead now, please.
Thank you. Co-chairs, members of the committee. I want to point out, too, that we have been able to reduce seclusion and restraint hours for the entire hospital, as you can probably see in your handout, from nearly 19,000 patient hours in 2006. That was during the period of time which the DOJ was out to see us, to just under 13,000 in 2007. Our eventual goal is to get to zero. And as outlandish as that may sound, I think we have to set our sights high on that. So I'm pleased that we've seen a significant reduction. I'm informed by staff who are working this area that it's primarily due to the implementation of this professional assault crisis training. It's a highly acknowledged training program. It really helps staff diffuse things before they get to the point where you have to get involved in a seclusion restraint episode. I wanted to say this because I think, you know, talking about staff morale issues, staff is suffering in many ways right now. This is a very difficult period for them. And we have to acknowledge the things that they're working on where we see concrete results. And this is a very concrete, significant achievement. And I want to make sure I put it on the record.
Bob, one other thing. The president just asked you about, the co-chair just asked you about, that we gave you 17 new nurses. Now, if you think in terms of dollars and cents, in terms of overtime or extended time that people work, 17 is going to hit that dent by how many dollars and cents? I think that's what the committee wanted to hear. If we gave you 17 new people and you were down 22 or 28, how much is the difference did that make? And I think they should know that because I'm going to tell you. If I was working that, you'd have to pay me combat pay. I'm going to tell you that right now. And so I think it's important that every little mark that you make, if we gave you 17 people, how much did that change the budget itself? And I think that would be helpful.
Co-chair Senator Carter, I'm hearing clearly that what we should do is give you the overtime hours by classification of position as well so that you can see what happened with overtime hours, for example, for nurses when we got 17 additional.
You gave us 17 additional people, Ms. Legislature, and this is what it did, and this is how much it changed the cost and that kind of stuff.
Mr. Chair, I want to follow up with the comment on overtime. I think we also want to know the high use of overtime, the why, if you took that money and actually put it into salaries and positions, would it change some of the other issues at the state hospital? You know, if I'm picking up on what the chair, the senator, is trying to get you to, what is it really? And I think I asked the question last time. Tell us specifically what it is you need. Because we have no way of sitting here to second guess you out there in that facility. So if you've got all this overtime, and we really sympathize with employees that are having to work straight hours, overtime, and that's not a good working environment anyway because you're tired and you're dealing with an environment that in the best of all worlds can be very combative, and you're putting the staff at risk. That's the reason I keep asking for the workers' comp accident rates. So the question is, if you're having these many overtime hours, why aren't we hiring additional people?
Co-chairs, Vice Chair Winters, in responding to your question about what do we need, we are preparing a response to that, and we will have that available for you shortly. It'll be very specific, very concrete, and it will be linked to the USDOJ report.
Okay, I have to get something on the record. Did you say, Superintendent Hammer, there's 2,000 patients out there?
Mr. Co-Chair, no, I'm sorry. 2,000 people, 1,200 staff, and about 700 patients.
I thought it was like 625, 60. It's gone. How many patients are out there today?
641.
Thank you. Thank you for that. I didn't mean to. I thought I about died when you said that because I got a little issue in my life I have to be sensitive to. All right.
Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, Representative Jensen, please.
Thank you. I guess what I'd, following up with Senator Winters' questions and Senator Carter's questions and concerns about the staffing issue, I'd like to know how many FTE you're budgeted for and how many you have online, sort of thing. You know, so that we can start to identify somewhere where the buck ends on this thing and move it forward.
Co-Chair, Representative Jensen, we have that information. We'll get it for you shortly.
Yeah.
Senator Farioli, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, we just heard about a reduction from 19,000 hours of restraint and seclusion to 13,000 hours in 07. And I was just referring back to the CRIPA report, and the recommendations in the CRIPA report are really specific. Eliminate the use of planned seclusion and planned restraint is their first recommendation. The second was eliminate standing orders for restraints and conclusion. Their third is eliminate prone restraints. And fourth, probably the most important, is make sure that restraints and seclusion are only used in connection with an overall plan for improvement for each individual patient that utilizes a suite of alternatives prior to actually using any sort of seclusion and restraint. And they all have to be part of a behavioral approach to treatment. They're predicated and keys to treatment. In Section 4 of your report, you talk about, or in Section 5 of your report, which you have yet to get to, you talk about establishing the goal, a long-term goal of elimination. The report talks about immediate elimination. And what concerns me is, as the chairman's pointed out, you're on watch. And the report is very specific. And I see a significant disconnect between wanting to phase in a long-term approach to the reduction over time of restraint and seclusion to reach a goal. But, you know, I envision when I hear that a period of weeks, months, or even years to get there. And this report tells me OSH should. And there's no equivocation in what I see as the time frame in those recommendations. Over what time do you think you're going to implement the elimination? And let me ask a follow-on after you give me some idea about that time frame.
Co-Chair, Senator Farioli, we need to draw a distinction here between planned seclusion and restraint, programmed seclusion and restraint, and I don't want to get too technical here, but what we're talking about is immediately eliminating the use of some forms of seclusion and restraint, which you described. The entire goal of getting to absolutely no use of seclusion and restraint is something that they're not telling us to get to immediately, in my understanding of the report. It's these other methods of using seclusion and restraint, and probably someone could go into more detail about this than I can. We will be clarifying with the Department of Justice what they mean by immediately, because sometimes, as you know, immediately means today, and sometimes it means we'll give you 2 weeks, and that'll be part of our discussion with them to determine exactly what they mean by the term immediately.
Mr. President, that gets precisely to the question that I have to ask now.
Well, please ask it. Thank you. I got a big one now.
All right. It seems to me that the things that you've listed in your report to us are things that have been ongoing improvements since 06, since before the release of this report. I don't know how closely they correlate with the absolute recommendations and requirements of CRIPA. And I am anxious to know that what you're doing now is very specifically focused on those things that we need to address to keep the state hospital from coming under order to transition to a facility beyond our control, but at our expense. And I guess the point I'm making here is, if there isn't a focus on quality of care issues that are directly connected to treatment modalities, to the kinds of patient improvement that are specifically required under CRIPA as a constitutional right, none of these things are going to matter. There's got to be a close coordination between the rights of patients, the treatment modalities that are demanded under CRIPA, and the actions that you're proposing and taking. And I haven't seen that correlation. As a matter of fact, 4 and 5 of your report indicate you've got an immediate need for an elimination of a treatment modality that the entire psychological industry discredits as being not a valid treatment modality unless and until it's specifically related to improvement of that patient in that particular patient's care. So getting to 13,000 hours of seclusion in 07 may be a valuable benchmark in your mind. I don't think CRIPA is going to be the people that did the inspection are going to be very impressed by it. So if you can help me understand, you're in a triage situation, I believe, with the CRIPA report. How are you correlating every action that you're taking with the specifics of the CRIPA report so that we don't end up receiving an order from the authorities that have produced this report that they, in fact, now are in control of the Oregon State Hospital?
Co-Chair Senator Perioli, it may be appropriate for us not to walk through these high-level things. I had hoped we could get through this in 10 to 15 minutes so that we could get to exactly what you're asking for, which is the more detailed point-by-point action plan and how we're going to address each specific thing. And since you have my notes in writing, I would propose that unless there's some questions about the other issues in the first part of our presentation, that we move fairly quickly and talk in more specifics.
I have to tell you, we'll be back next week, but we don't finish tonight because I do think some of these questions are revealing. I mean, I have no idea what you just said on seclusion and restraint. I am completely lost now on seclusion and restraint is a treatment mechanism, I guess, used for individuals that are under your jurisdiction, the Oregon State Hospital. I don't know what's going on here. So, I mean, I really don't, in view of what the report says. So I'm just going to tell you that. And that's the high... What was the language you just used, Mr. Nichol? We avoid what? The high what?
High level.
This high level. If that's high level, then I don't know what to do about that. So I guess, Senator Farrell, do you have more questions?
Just an observation, Mr. Chair. I have the sense that if you and I were on shift on staff and we had a patient who had, if we had patient-on-patient violence, if we had a patient who was... acting out because of a psychotic behavioral state, if we had understaffed conditions extreme overtime and fatigue, I don't know that we'd have much to resort to other than medication or restraints or the kinds of situations that we see in this report. So, you know, what I find frustrating is the... I don't doubt for a second that we need to bring the IT system into the 21st century. That's probably a big necessity, but it strikes me as painting the buildings at Chernobyl. You know, what needs to happen is that the treatments that touch people have to be brought up to standard very, very quickly, and that means a lot more people. And I do understand you've got tremendous difficulty in hiring and attracting people to work in this environment, first. And secondly, there's a shortage of the qualified people that you need. But anything that we do that isn't directly on task in that area is going to delay eventually meeting all the goals of CRIPA and increase the propensity for this whole system to flip over and go to the feds. And I don't think that's what we want to see here. So that's what I'm feeling now, that the staff, no matter how hard they try, they cannot make up the difference between the CRIPA standard and what they have to work with at the facility.
Can I ask, when did the issue of restraints and that states had to comply with certain federal regulations come into being, number one, because somewhere in my historical memory bank up here, the issue of restraints and those and the request for more staff at OSA, at the hospital, occurred during Mazahart and others. I mean, this is just not a new subject, nor has it been a new issue with the feds. So kind of help me as to when federally these new regulations were imposed on the Oregon State Hospital, so I can understand a time span, because my little memory bank says that this is not new.
Co-chairs, Vice Chair Winter, I think we're pretty hard pressed to give you exact dates and exact regulations.
Is there somebody in the audience who knows? Maybe Mary, remember? No? Okay.
Go ahead. You'd be hard pressed.
Yeah, at this very moment, but we can go back and research that and see if we can determine that.
Thank you.
Co-chair.
Representative Jensen, please.
I don't want to keep writing this seclusion and restraint, Connie. But I know your goal, long-term goal, is elimination. Do you mean by elimination zero? And what, given the nature of the folks, the problems of the folks you have, et cetera, you know, that whole, you know, conflict, what is an achievable goal?
Co-chairs, Representative Jensen, when I say zero, I mean zero. That is the goal. What would it take to get there? You know, the simple answer is considerable more staff and good, solid, constant training and retraining of people.
Okay. I understand, you know, and I read that into your statement, that that's what your goal is. But, you know, we talk about this 19,000 hours as, you know, a lot of hours, and I submit, yes, it is. But when I look at the total number of patient hours per year in your custody, it's something less than 0.3% of the time. And that, you know, I think we need to, I mean, 19,000 hours in the life of one patient is a lot of time in restraint. So I'm back kind of on the same question I've raised in a number of other times tonight. I'd like to get to the perfect, but I'd like to have some idea of, is that even remotely achievable?
Co-chairs, Representative Jensen, we are working on those kind of benchmarks so that we can look at what we think is achievable in 3 to 6 months, 12 to 18 months, and then longer term, meaning probably 3 to 4 years.
That's what I need to be able to understand.
Are you going to give us those benchmarks sometime?
Co-chair, we'd be happy to.
Thank you. Representative Berger, please.
Yeah, this, Mr. Chair, is for you. Representative Rosenbaum and I have another meeting at 7 o'clock.
Oh, sure.
And it, clearly this high-level piece was not what we were looking for, and I understand that there's more detailed work out there, and I guess I'd like to move on to something that's... And it's not that I mind... going over these things, I just think we're looking for a lot more detail, and so I'm asking you if we could move on to some of that, because some of us...
I appreciate that comment, and Mr. Co-Chair, I was just writing you a note because we do have this other hearing. I would find it helpful if we could have some discussion among the committee members about what sorts of testimony we would want to hear in future hearings. I know that Representative Hanna just suggested to me that one thing we could do is allow a report to be completed but have written questions that we could submit to the witnesses so that they could respond in writing or at least know what it was that we were trying to get from them. And I do hope that there will be a time when the public, or at least some invited members of the public, can come forward and talk to us about what their perspective is, too, because I think it's valuable to hear these responses from the people in charge, but there's also, I think, a real role for the people that work in these institutions or their unions or other advocates who are out there who might have some pretty valuable insights.
President Klim?
I don't know if you want to go back and address that first. My mind is back on the seclusion and restraint, a very specific question. So maybe we should stick with there.
You've got 15 minutes left, some of you, if that's what you're saying. You can get into other things. Obviously, I thought we were going to get a different presentation here tonight. The idea that people in the audience want to talk, I understand that. We're going to get to that kind of input. We're trying to get to some other things before we get to that. I mean that sincerely. This Q&A, though, I hope is revealing to the individuals who are responsible of the kinds of things we want to know. And I don't know how else to do that. I thought we'd have a lot more detail, layperson's type of detail, time, deadlines, benchmarks. I thought that would all be spelled out tonight as opposed to what we're getting here tonight. I'm not trying to be critical. I'm just telling you that. I think questions have revealed that, not just from me, but from many of us. So I guess you should simply, we'll work our way through what you have here tonight, and we'll come back next week, and we'll do the more detail. I don't know how else to get to that, if you know what I mean. If you want to prepare questions, have him. We have to probably take more than 1 week. They'll come up with a document. We'll distribute it. Then you can come up with questions in response to that they can have ahead of time. Is that what you're saying? You want to do?
Well, that's certainly one option. Yeah. I think what I'm thinking is just how do we make the most productive use of what's a pretty limited time that we're going to have, just meeting once a week. I am curious if there are other people who do think that we should be hearing from other folks in addition. I know that's part of the future plan.
Right.
Mr. Chairman, well, I think we need to use the CRIPA report as a point of focus. For instance, there's 12 separate recommendations on restraint and seclusion. There's 9 specific recommendations on nursing care. And at least for the immediate term, although this can't possibly be all the concerns that we have about operating in the state hospital. In the immediate term, addressing each one of those 9 issues with a specific plan and a timeline and even a cost estimate, I think are going to be critical to keeping the full implementation of CRIPA from removing the state hospital from state control. We have that as a roadmap, and I guess I would suggest one approach, just one, would be to go through the recommendation phase of the CRIPA report and stick a timeline, an action, and an actor on each one of those things. And at least that would give me the idea of who I could ask questions to about the specifics of a remediation plan. You have it.
That's what this is.
What?
And we have to sound to you.
Okay, let's start that meeting right now.
Just when we're getting ready to end.
I would remind everyone, it is the report. We set the committee up to, with oversight, to get us in compliance with what the Fed said we had to comply. That is where we're at. We're not into, there's other committees, other task forces are going to be formed to deal with all that. That's why this group exists. So, all right, we have documents here. Let's continue. If individuals have to leave, I understand. Just continue to 7:30, and then we'll end the meeting wherever we're at and come back more. Yes, did you?
Mr. Chair, maybe what we ought to do is take these documents home and study, and then we can come back, and all of us would be fresh, and we'd have the idea that this correlates to the report.
Well, we can take it home, but I do respect the fact you prepared this document. Definitely to you, if you wish to speak further than document, I hope I would ask at least those who can remain to remain to have you work through this, because you did prepare it, because I do think anything... Enlightenment is critical, at least to me, and everything I hear is new for me. I'm learning. I don't have the background that some members of the committee have, and surely you have, and many people in the audience have. So I would like to at least continue to have them work from this document. I realize this document here requires more study, Senator Ferrioli, and so we'll proceed that way. For those who have to leave, I understand. 7:30, we're shutting her down. Proceed, please.
Mr. Co-Chair, I think I was on point number 5. All management staff have been trained in trauma-informed care and started systematic debriefings for staff and patients. after seclusion and restraint has to be used. So we've, again, as I've several times said, we've established our long-term goal, the elimination of seclusion and restraint. And I point out here that it will, in my opinion, it will require additional resources. The sixth point, we've created an electronic critical incident medication.
What are we going to hear about those resources? When are you going to make the official ask in dollars? What are you going to make the ask?
Mr. Co-Chair, we have a draft document already. I think we're prepared to give that to you in the next day or two.
All right. Proceed. Thank you.
We have created an electronic critical incident medication error reporting system. Again, this is prior to the completion of the BHIP, the Behavioral Integration Project, but we feel that it's important enough that we need to have a tracking system to do that so that we respond promptly. Staff have used intensive consultation from two experts. Mickey Logan mentioned these individuals to you last Friday, Dr. Jeff Geller and Dr. Chris McLaughlin. They'll be back at the end of this month. I'm going to be meeting with them. Mr. Hammer will meet with them. Dr. Goldberg will meet with them, and we're going to go through another intensive round of consultation. We'll work through the action plan with them. Now, all of the detail that you just received in this document, we'll be going over that with a fine-tooth comb with them and getting their input on that. I think we mentioned before, too, that we entered a two-year agreement with Oregon Health and Sciences University Public Psychiatry Training Program. We've brought three highly qualified psychiatrists into our medical staff. We had enough vacancies that we continued to recruit just like we've always done for regular staff positions, and we'll continue to do that. But we were able to bring in six additional staff psychiatrists and one research evaluation professional to fill longstanding vacant positions and bolster an overworked medical staff. We've created several patient-centered projects. The Empowerment Center on the state hospital grounds is there to assist with transitioning patients to the community, staffed by longtime advocate Gary Scholander. We have the founder of Worldwide Dual Diagnosis Anonymous in Oregon. He's now leading 80 different groups throughout the state, self-help based on AA, adapted for people with mental illnesses and alcohol and drug problems. The largest group in the state meets at Oregon State Hospital. I think I'm hearing that there are 20 people attending on a regular basis at Pendleton. We had our first meeting yesterday. Of the 57 patients, 45 showed up for that meeting. I think that speaks well to the issues of peer support. And we're also about to implement a peer mentoring program and a peer support program within the state hospital. We're also moving, as we mentioned before, to the treatment mall idea, and that's housing, a town where treatment takes place and recreation are separated to simulate a more realistic living environment. We're designing our new state facilities with that same concept in mind. We have a staff psychologist, Dr. Alexander Milkey, who's developing a science-based risk assessment process. He's working closely with the Psychiatric Security Review Board so that we at least have a common language to talk about risk assessment, and will help improve the discharge planning process. And finally, to get a better handle on our fiscal issues, I transferred Bob Furlow, who had been the superintendent at Eastern Oregon Blue Mountain Recovery Center. He had 16 years of military hospital management experience, and we've made him the chief financial officer, and that's been a great help in really getting a handle on our financial issues at both state hospitals. So I think that walks you through quickly the remaining points, and I appreciate the opportunity to go through these.
Any questions this time?
Yes,
sure.
How did you come in?
Yes.
Okay. How did you deal with the issue of who's coming and who's leaving? Having a better a handle on knowing who's there and who's gone. I noticed that was in the report, and I left my notes. And
Co-Chair Senator Carter, is that the issue related to discharge planning, or is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
You know who's coming.
Intake.
That's right. Intake and discharge.
Well, Co-Chair Senator Carter, the report is accurate in saying that we don't have direct control over admissions or discharges. These are all court-ordered people, either civilly committed or criminally court-committed or sent to us for evaluations. What we do have control over, and I think this is important, is the quality of our treatment and how we process people and then how we work toward discharge planning. We do have fairly direct control over the discharge of civilly committed patients, and we have a whole array of community resources for those people to go into. But that system is actually working fairly well. In 1994, in some of my early years with the state office, I had consultations with a nationally known consultant and came up with the idea of the extended care management unit, which looks at people from an outside view from the state hospital and helps create matches for them in the community. And I think that system has worked very well over the last 14 years now. It's hard to believe it's there that long. On the criminal commitment side, that's an issue that we have to work in close partnership with the Psychiatric Security Review Board, and we meet with them regularly. We're talking about particularly the risk assessment tool. I know Dr. Milkey has met with several members of the PSRB, including Norwood Knight Richardson and Barry Cast and Dr. Cliff Johansson. And we don't expect that the PSRB has to sign off 100% on that process because they have to make their own independent decisions. But I felt that we needed a much more common language so that when we talk together, we have a clearer common understanding about what the risk factors are and what we need to account for in discharge planning. So while we don't have direct control over discharges, I think we have to take every opportunity to do the right thing in terms of treatment and discharge planning so that we're not stumbling over ourselves.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman,
the reason I was asking a question, because that's what Representative Jensen was talking about earlier, and that is that there has to be some kind of collaborative action between what the court does, what PSRB does, and then what you guys do, because when it comes down to the bottom line, here you are being indicted with a report on things that you're not necessarily responsible for. You're not responsible for who comes and who leaves because the PSRB does some of that, and then the court system does the rest of it. How can you better track that kind of activity and or have better collaboration so that the next time around you're not indicted on something that you have no control over?
Co-Chair Senator Carter, another initiative that we initiated just in the last 6 months is to look at the three counties that have sent the largest number of court-ordered patients for evaluation. And so we have three projects going on, one in Lane County, one in Marion County, and one in Washington County. And the attempt there is to try to get to the front door and see if there's any alternatives for these patients to come to the state hospital that's still safe in the community. Often what they really need is to get reconnected or connected for the first time with good quality community mental health services, and for the first time we have some resources to do that. So that's another way that I think we need to not just stand back and say we can't do anything about this. We need to take creative alternatives and try to get in front of the door sometimes when we have the ability to do that.
Mr. Chair, would you take not just a look, but really examine the issue of where you have forensic patients who have committed violent and criminal acts inside of the institution, and where there is no sanction given, and look at that in a way of whether or not, or maybe legislatively, we will have to take some action to whether those individuals are sent to DLC. But you have an environment out there at this institution, and I think sometimes that the general public doesn't understand the environment out at the Oregon State Hospital where you're talking civil and criminal. And I'm looking at knowing that there have been some individuals who have done some egregious acts out there, and yet nothing occurs. So, I mean, it could very well be that one of the recommendations that come from you that also is a management issue or an issue that this body needs to take up and address. So I would hope that you are going to explore that as a part of your recommended packages.
Co-Chair, Vice Chair Winters, that's an issue that we have been dealing with for some time, and we'd be happy to bring back some proposals on how to do that more effectively.
Because this body doesn't know all of the environment that's going on in your institution, and the only way that we know it is if you bring it to us, and you bring it to us that this is a situation or an issue that we need you, the legislative branch, to assist us with.
so that we, one, can keep good staff out there. You've got a culture out there where you're dealing with sometimes some very violent individuals, and some of whom do egregious act on staff. And I also am aware that sometimes there's no repercussion that happens with those who does the act. So I just ask that you look at that and examine it very carefully, and if you have some solutions, to bring them forth to us.
Representative May, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. I'm following up on this, too, and I wrote a series of questions that I'd like to give you to answer. It seems to me from this report, and I can't find the specifics in here, but as I read, that there were forensic patients who were sent to the hospital, and I'm assuming that the hospital does not have any say. You don't have a psychiatrist who sees these patients who have been admitted. And so it would be the attorney who was probably meeting with the DA who makes a decision that we're going to plea bargain, this person will go to the hospital. So the implication was that people would be admitted inappropriately to the hospital who really aren't mentally ill, but perhaps did a plea bargain that they would be sent to the hospital. And then they're going to be in the hospital for some time, and their behavior will become more aggressive because they're not mentally ill. Am I remembering that correctly?
Co-Chair, it's Representative Tomei. I think you're very close to the mark. There are a number... I think the dividing line of a lot of our folks, especially the more aggressive ones, is ones who they may have some issues with mental health when they come in, whether it's substance-induced, methamphetamine, that kind of thing. We can help them, and they become stabilized, and they don't need hospital level of care, and they're still really aggressive. Those are very difficult to handle. There aren't too many sanctions. There aren't too many things we can do. And many of these folks are quite smart. They're not dumb. And so your normal behavioral management plans really don't work very well on them. There is a cadre who come in because of plea bargaining that shouldn't be there. And there are also a lot of folks who come in who actually have substantial mental illnesses. And I think, in general, you won't ever hear staff complaining about those folks. That's what we're there for, and staff recognize that.
And if I follow up, then also I hear that many people are in the prisons who probably should be getting mental health care who are not.
Because, Representative Tomei, you're right. Their estimates range from 4,000 to 5,000 people with major mental illnesses who are in the prison system in this state. So we're talking in the state hospital, of course, about three-quarters of the patients currently are criminally court-committed. Look at the trends.
That's just a huge amount, Mr. Co-Chair. That just...
Are you talking about all prisoners or just state prisoners?
Co-Chair Courtney, the studies that I've seen indicate that as many as 4,000 to 5,000 of our state DOC prisoners have mental illnesses.
Thank you. Now, I
wanted to comment just quickly on the issue of things, since I'm also the addictions director for the state. This issue of people with co-occurring disorders is a major one. There are studies out of Chicago that show that 90% of the people with mental illnesses who run into the criminal justice system have alcohol and drug problems, and that's very typical of the forensic patients that we see as well. It may or may not be 90%. I think it's probably pretty close to that. That's why things like Dual Diagnosis Anonymous are a critical treatment option for us to have both in the hospital and outside. But one of the reasons that people get into the hospital and they may appear and actually have all of the symptoms of a mental illness is they may be on methamphetamine, they may be having methamphetamine psychoses, and these drugs are powerful enough that the symptoms don't go away right away, even with medications. And there's some evidence that some people do irreparable damage to themselves through methamphetamine and other mixed drug usage. So it's a real clinical dilemma a lot of times for people who come in to sort out what's the alcohol and drug problem and what's the mental illness. Okay. Sometimes they blend into each other.
If I can follow up, Mr. Co-Chair. So at a point then when someone has gone through treatment and they're a forensic patient, and they've gone through treatment, and they're cured in a sense that they're well now, and they could go out into the community. Is there a process in which they can go through that, rather, say, if the crime were, if they'd gone to prison, they would have been in prison, say, for 20 years. They've been in the hospital 1 or 2 years, and they've gone through treatment, and they're healthy now. Is there a process for those folks to be sent out into the community, or are you obliged to hold on to them for a long period of time?
Coach, as Roxanne Tomei, the process is that they're committed to the Psychiatric Security Review Board by reason of guilty except for insanity. They have a term of their commitment to the PSRB. In order for them to leave the hospital, the PSRB has to make a specific decision about what's called conditional release. They can be released then from the hospital into the community, but they continue under the terms and length of their sentence to the PSRB to be under the adjudication of the board in the community, and they have very tight restrictions and very specific conditions attached to them. If they violate those, they can be taken back to the hospital without a hearing.
Thank you.
Senator Farioli, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to follow up on both Representative Tomei and Senator Carter's questions. One of the things that was discussed in the report are civil commitments, people who come in civilly, who over a period of time meet all of the criterion for discharge and yet may be retained in the facility for months or even years after having met the criteria for discharge. And the report documented a couple of cases, you know, specifically where there were 18 civil patients on the discharge list for more than a year, 15 for more than 6 months, and 31 for more than 3 months after they were authorized for transfer to a community-based facility. And, you know, I can't think of anything more analogous to being buried alive than having been into a mental institution, being cleared for release, and not being allowed to leave. The report correlated that issue with a problem between administration of OSH and the community-based care providers, who essentially have been allowed to, in the words of the report, cherry-pick the patients that they'll allow to come into their facilities. How can you justify keeping people in this facility who have met all the criterion when you have control of the contract and you have control of that patient? And please tell me that we are working on that particular issue, because I can't think of anything that creates a greater liability than illegally prolonging what amounts to incarceration.
Co-Chair Senator Farioli, that isn't acceptable for us to keep those people for those lengths of time, and you'll see that we are working specifically on how to prevent that from happening.
Representative, can I get an idea of how many people fall into that category today?
Co-Chair Courtney, Senator Farioli, yes, we have that number. I don't have it handy right now, but we'll get it for you.
Well, I think those folks have to be considered to be a very top priority. They'll cut our costs too, Mr. President.
Representative Jensen, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. Just as a footnote Senator Farioli's comment, staff and I are looking at possibility of legislation to address this particular problem. And I don't know, they need to talk to us about whether or not you're going to need specific statutory justification to deal with that particular issue. I'm not proposing that you do that right now, Bob, because but one of the things, Mr. Co-Chair, if you indulge me just a second, that bothers me a whole bunch, and that is the ability of, excuse me, Mr. Co-Chair, I know you're an attorney, but the ability of two attorneys to negotiate a plea bargain for not guilty by reason of insanity, or whatever the appropriate terminology would be. I don't with all respect to people in the legal profession, I think they are potentially out on a limb with a saw in their hand, not sure what side they're cutting on. And I would like somewhere, Mr. Co-Chair, if we can have it, some discussion on, you know, either from the folks here or from the Justice Department or DA's Department, you know, on exactly what the legal ramifications are of plea bargaining for not guilty by reason of.
Exactly. I think it's not guilty except for.
Except for.
I think.
Except for, yes.
I just want to say, you know, I see now that Peter is becoming the subject of the oversight. Is that right?
Yes.
Yeah, I see. Okay. Thank you. Do you want to say something before I go to Senator Buenos?
Co-chair, the term is guilty except for insanity.
I just said that.
I wondered where I heard that.
Go ahead, Senator. It's very unique to Oregon. That phrase is very unique to Oregon.
I believe, Mr. Nichols, you mentioned dual diagnosis. And that your friends, some of the forensic patients, and I don't know what percentage, also had drug issues and what have you. Does that pose, what security issues does that pose? Are you seeing, is there any, because I know in dealing with corrections, there is the issue, particularly sometimes with the population, that you have contraband. Is there a problem with contraband getting into the institution? If there is, what kind of security methods are being put in place to work on that?
Mr. Chair, Vice Chair Winters, I'll let Mr. Hammer talk in more detail about that, but is it an issue that we have to constantly be aware of? Yes. I know that we had just an attempt this week to have a delivery of some methamphetamine, from what I understand. We have to be watching for that constantly. We have policies and security staff, and Mr. Hammer can say more in detail about how we do that, but it's an issue.
Okay. We're winding down. You know, Dr. Goldberg, you haven't said anything all night long. And that bothers me. So why don't you enter a statement for the record?
Co-Chair, Courtney, members of the committee, I was here tonight to answer any questions, and that's my presence here tonight.
Well, that was helpful. Representative Flynn, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On this, I'm going to go home and study this document, the United States Department of Justice Civil Rights of Institutionalized Persons Act High-Level Measures. The thing I think I would be interested in on an ongoing basis is another column that sort of says, you know, how the problem gets fixed. Because what you've got is, like, seclusion, restraint, and then current results, how many hours, long-term goal reduced to zero, and then, you know, the question is, or a column that says more staff gets you to zero. So then we know, you know, what helps us help you meet your long-term goal. And I do, just so we get it on the record, because I'm not sure it was understood clearly, planned restraint is much different than restraint that occurs as a product. If you want to go over that, I think it would be probably helpful. Because planned restraint is an acknowledged unconstitutional activity. Restraint that occurs in lieu of, you know, an emergency situation is something that will happen if you don't have an alternative, which then staffing is a byproduct of not having alternatives. You can't send someone down to group, you know, if you have no group, and instead you have to basically restrain them. So maybe you want to go through that a little bit.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clem, yeah, that was one of the issues I was fumbling awkwardly with, and I didn't do a good job of explaining it. I think maybe Mr. Hammer can take another shot at it.
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Clem, this, I'm not sure how to explain it satisfactorily. The program restraint is always an issue. That's a planned restraint where the restraint is figured in as part of the treatment, and it's controversial because many feel it's a failure of the treatment to actually address the issues of the patient, and some don't feel that way. But that's a very controversial kind of issue. The other form of restraint tends to be in those emergency situations where there's aggression, staff-patient, patient-to-patient, where a large group of people and a small number of staff, where a restraint and often a seclusion
is necessary given the facilities we're in and the level of staffing and the alternatives for some of these folks who are not exhibiting classic signs of mental illness, who may just be aggressive because of some of the issues we've already talked about. And so they are secluded and restrained to calm down. And there are observation requirements for those folks. And I think that the major distinction is emergency and handling developing aggressive situations as opposed to building in restraint as part of a treatment plan.
I might just follow up. It seems to me, to key off on my friend Senator Farioli's comments, to really focus in on what they said is going to lead to taking over a lawsuit. It's clear they feel the planned restraint is unconstitutional, clearly. So that one is going to have to go real quickly. That can't wait. I mean, that's on our work list is the staffing level that gets it. So whenever there's somebody who right now their current active treatment plan doesn't have anything other than planned restraint, that's going to have to change immediately. And or we're going to court, no doubt about it. And that's us. I mean, that's us. We need to pay for the things that get it so they have a group therapy to go to instead of a straitjacket.
Co-Chair Representative Clem, exactly. Those are the things that we do plan to change immediately, and to the degree we need additional resources to do that, we will bring that forward.
All right. Representative Berger had to leave. What was your question?
Thank you, Chair. Just she'll be reading these forms over the next couple of days, and did ask if you can email her, and I'd suggest maybe the members as well in case we can't get to it. Just what the different forms are, maybe a description of what the categories mean. I would say make sure to describe any acronyms. There are actually a couple of things that are clear. And then how they maybe interrelate. Just so the novice reader could thoroughly understand if they're not here, potentially hearing from you tonight about them. So.
All right.
Mr. Chair, if I could ask for just a little bit more clarification. Are you talking about the use of any acronyms in our action plan?
Well, any of these documents, okay. but especially describing each one, what the different columns really mean. And then it looks like some of them either interrelate or maybe there's some, not redundancy, but there's similarities in how they use differently.
Yes, Mr. Superintendent.
Mr. Co-Chair, that was actually where I was going to start off, and we'll be happy to do that. These are complex issues, and we're making an attempt to try to sort them out. I would like to say that I personally, on behalf of the staff, appreciate your attention, your questions, and your guidance. And we're hopeful as you get into these and ask questions based on these documents that they'll help move us along. We will be working with our consultants. There are a lot of hard issues here, and I think the perspectives you bring to it are very helpful. The general relationship of these documents is this. We started working on our, what I would call, a strategic plan. It doesn't meet all the tests of a strategic plan. Some of us call it an aspirational plan. You've heard of it as a continuous improvement plan. All those are generic terms. They don't really identify it. We all recognized started for the last 4 years that there were major areas of the hospital that needed improvement, from treatment to facilities to staffing levels to the data processing, communication, culture, everything. So with guidance, and it did, we started on it after the U.S. Department of Justice left, but we also had two major joint commission surveys and the Department of Justice exit to give us some guideposts. Staff worked mightily on this, and we developed that plan. From that plan, knowing that a plan doesn't do any good if we don't have some way of implementing it, we developed an action plan with work groups and assigned responsibilities. You will see that in this document that says Oregon State Hospital Continuous Improvement Action Plan. That's really the individual items that implement the Continuous Improvement Plan. And divert for just a moment to address Senator Ferrioli's comment a while back. As we matched this up with the CRIPA report, we did not do it to meet CRIPA. We did it to try to improve patient care. The patients come first. We're also very sensitive to the issues around the staff and the assaults and the aggression and the patient treatment. But as we sat down with the CRIPA report and matched up the items where we thought we needed to improve internally, I think you will see from the larger, one of the legal size document there, the crosswalk document, that they match up pretty well. It's difficult. It's detailed. There are 35 pages of findings and recommendations in the CRIPA report, so we have a lot of work to do. And I think your perspective on and the types of questions you're asking and the types of priorities that you would have a set will be really helpful. So the legal document that says it's a crosswalk document, it's a fairly thick one, legal size, that really is matching up the continuous improvement planning stuff and the action plan to the items, the findings and recommendations directly in the CRIPA report, and it shows us where we need to be working. And the last document is this three-page. This is really just a timeline that shows the timing where we hope to implement the action plan. All of this will be subject to change as we move along and put things in priority and try to figure out what can change with your help and our consultants' help. But that's the relationship of the documents, and we'll be happy to send you something in writing on that.
Rick? Thank you. Just to clarify, too, we had a little sidebar question. You do have some national experts on contract assisting in this process. And I guess the question is, are these consultants coming back on a regular basis and doing kind of a DOJ review every so often? Similar to what DOJ did, but is that what their role is? So are there people coming through externally, kind of seeing how you're doing, going?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Berkobian, we talked a little bit about this on Friday, I believe. Dr. McLaughlin was the court master for the state of Hawaii for the period of time when they were under court receivership, nationally known PhD nurse. The other consultant is Dr. Jeffrey Geller from Massachusetts. He's published tons of things. He's also been very involved with the U.S. DOJ on other CRIPA investigations. These are probably the two best people in the country we could have gotten to be consultants.
They actually go to the hospital and do reviews and...
Yes.
Okay.
I just have a question because I noticed that a part of your leadership team on your Oregon State Hospital Continuous Improvement Plan. Is Dr. Fickle still with you?
Mr. Co-Chair, Senator Winters, he's with us as a staff psychiatrist. He's in Treatment Unit 50G.
Fine. But I'd like to ask a request, though. I want to follow up on what Representative Rosenbaum started on future meetings and invited individuals. I really think that it's important that we invite the staff as well to be able to come and to talk to us. I want to put some sidebars on it because I can remember when I did the OWCC review a lot of years ago. That I'm very cognizant of making certain that when staff comes before us, that we give them the assurance that they can be very open and very forthright in their conversation with us, and that anything that they say to us as legislators, that there is the assurance from management that there will be no retaliation. I just have to put things out there just the way they are, but I also know that staff often can provide us with a view of the way things are going that sometimes we may overlook or not even think about, and they are part of, I believe, the success of the as we go forward.
Thank you so much. We're going to be here when? Next time, next week, same time, same place? No. When is it?
Either Tuesday or Thursday, I thought.
Yeah.
I've been decided, yes.
So it'll be Tuesday or Thursday next week, but not because we have conflicts.
You can choose a day right now if you'd like. Or we can contact your offices.
Let's contact the offices because we got it. This is getting session is going to get hectic, so I want to make sure we have as big a turnout as we can. Okay. Representative Flynn, please.
Just one more piece to follow up on Senator Winter's comments. I do want to make sure we have an opportunity for an open public hearing, because I'm receiving things that are really useful, but they're coming, you know, back channel to home emails. And I mean, I've got a document here that's from a woman who works there, and this is a internal suggestions for improvement that the hospital did a couple years ago. A lot of these are great, and they actually match up with the report. She felt like they weren't listened to. It might have been just a pure resource issue, like acknowledged, placed on a wish list, but nothing could be done about it. You know, I would like to have her. We've got parents of current patients who they know whether or not things have changed since that report was done in 06. I mean, whether things are really still just like that last week. There's no way for them to be able to, you know, accept emails and out in the parking lot get that out. If they're willing to come forward and talk, I think we would learn a tremendous amount. I mean, there's an issue just in here about the way you design the seclusion room could eliminate restraints anyway, period, just based on design that she knows because she's done this at four other facilities around the country already. But, you know, this thing is 2 years old, and none of it was implemented, and I think she would like to be able to talk probably.
Okay. Yes, we do have to broaden the input. All right, anything further? All right, thank you for coming to the meeting. We are adjourned.